My guest Richard Rodriguez has just written the third volume of his memoirs about being Mexican-American. His new book, Brown, is in part an examination of what it's like to be neither black nor white in a country that is obsessed with race. Rodriguez is a contributing editor for Harper's Magazine and the Sunday Opinion section of the LA Times. He's also an essayist for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS. Rodriguez opposes the brand of multiculturalism that emphasizes the politics and literature of identity. He writes, "It's one thing to know your author, man or woman or gay or black or paraplegic or president. It's another thing to choose only man or woman or gay or black as the only voice empowered to address you." But here's the paradox. Although he takes issue with certain aspects of the literature of identity, all of his books are about being Mexican-American.
What I oppose is the relegation of literature to sociology, and that what I'm those readers who use books as a way of reducing a human life to a kind of case study or type. I describe in Brown this moment when I was doing a reading some years ago at the University of Arizona in Tucson. And I had the 6:30 slot. There was a lesbian poet who was coming on at 8 o'clock. And so there at 6:30, I had my Mexican-American readers, and God bless them, they came, postponing their dinners, to listen to the Mexican-American writer. And somewhere in the course of my reading, this young Mexican-American, who was probably impatient with my voice and with my prose, noisily got up and walked out of the auditorium. And at the moment at which he opened the back doors, I could see all the lesbians waiting in the lobby for their lesbian poet. And I thought to myself, why couldn't I get the lesbians at my reading and the lesbians take the the Mexican-Americans get the lesbian poet? Why do we always use literature in this way simply as a way of discovering ourself? Why don't we discover ourselves in the other? That's obviously been the great engagement of my life, trying to find myself in African-American literature, for example, to the point now that I cannot imagine the voice I'm using now, without having read James Baldwin. He gave me my voice.
In what way did he give you your voice?
He taught me, I remember reading Baldwin, especially Baldwin the Essayist, in the 1950s, when I was a very precocious young reader. I've just been moving away from Spanish, which is my mother tongue, moving into this new language. And Baldwin had this clarity of style that also disguised and held in check his anger with such elegance that he taught me the way to use language that was fierce and hot and urgent, but do it in a way that allowed the reader to breathe. And I thought I remember watching him on Baldwin on David Susskind's TV show in the 50s. This dates me, I realize, and I remember his frog eyes as he came on the show and his cigarette and the way his eyebrows would arch at Susskind's question. And I thought to myself, this is the writer. This is what I want to be. And I found my model in him.
You talk about wanting to melt down categories so that, you know, to realize that so many people in America are made up of different groups, so it's hard to just like define yourself as one type, one ethnic group, one cultural group. I'm wondering if being gay has affected your sense of that, because, you know...
Oh, it's been a huge influence on my life. I didn't realize that really until I was writing this book, because what I recognized was that my lifelong preoccupation has been with this question of the dangerous love. The most dangerous thing about me as a boy was that I was wrongly in love. I remember there was a moment. I must have been about 9 years old. I had a very good friend, and I was frustrated by. I had a crush on him, and I was frustrated by that fact. And I remember one day throwing a hammer at him, at his face, which he deflected, but it hit him. And I remember our mothers talking that night on the telephone, and I remember my mother saying somewhere in the course of the conversation, well, boys would be boys, which is to say, boys finally get in fights. But I thought to myself, even then, you know, that if she only knew that I had a crush on my friend, the ceiling would collapse. The whole world would turn upside down. That the most dangerous thing that I could say was that I was in love with him. So that as a very young boy, not only do I begin to guard my eyes, but I also begin to focus my eyes on those exceptions. The Irish bar in 19th century New York, with one solitary African-American face, who is he? Why is he here? I want to know that question. I want to ask that question because that's what the question that I begin to ask myself. Why do I go to listen to Malcolm X? What is driving me there? Why am I the only Mexican in the crowd in 1965 listening to Malcolm X? Why am I the only Mexican in the crowd, apparently, at a British comedy that comes, a traveling show that comes through Sacramento? What is that except some kind of desire to fall in love with those things that don't inevitably belong to me?
Are there things that are supposed to define you in Mexican culture that are completely the opposite of the things that are supposed to define you in gay culture, like what it means to be a man, the sense of macho?
Yes. So what, in Mexican culture, what it means to be a man is to have children. You may be cruel toward your wife and sentimental toward your mother, which is what Mexican men tend to be, but you also have to have children, preferably sons, who are as dreadful as you are.
I'm going to stop you. Can you get away with saying that, that you may be cruel to your wife and sentimental toward your mother?
Yes, I think you can. I did it in my second book, and no one has objected.
Uh-huh.
There is a cruelty in Mexico toward the wife that is balanced by a kind of sentimentality about mother. Mexicans are enormously sentimental about mamacita and casual about betrayals of the wife. Machismo is not a word that accidentally happens in Mexico. There's a kind of sexual license given the male that's real. My great sin in Mexico is that I'm a joto. I am a queer. But the evidence of that is that I'm dry, that I'm without children, and that I'm half a man or less because of that. And that obviously weighs on me. You know, the great drama of some of in my early books was that anxiety about having soft hands, that anxiety about not being manly in the way that my father was manly, that anxiety of having too many words, that I, you know, that there is a saying in Spanish that a man should be feo, fuerte, y formal, ugly, strong, and formal is almost the English word formal, but it's sober. A man should be sober, and what that means is, as I understood it, is that you're not chatty. And I was chatty. I was like a woman as a boy. I had too many words. They were spilling out of my mouth. Whereas my father was always formal. My father, whenever people were in need, whenever there was emergency, my father was always there, but always silent. And I never had that. I had too many words.
In your book, you make the point that although you are often described as Hispanic, you're not really sure that Hispanic is something that really exists. There's no Hispanics in Mexico or Argentina or Chile. What do you mean?
I mean that Richard Nixon's administration created that category in the 1970s. They created the category of the Asian, and that in many ways it's an absurd notion. But it comes into a country that has always been, in its deepest obsession, obsessed with blood and race. So now most of your listeners probably think that Hispanics constitute some new third race in America, that there is now some brown race called Hispanics. Well, I want to tell your listeners that we do not exist as a racial group, that you are wrong about us. We are an ethnic group. We believe that we belong to a culture. By asserting one's Hispanicity, what is saying is one is related to religion, to language, to food, to recipes, to weather. When my mother watches Univision or Telemundo, the Spanish language television networks, she'll watch a program, say a discussion show, and she will see the audience, and there will be blonde women, peroxided or not. There will be black men. There will be brown people like us. And she doesn't say, oh, they're of different races. She says, son todos Latinos, by which she means we are united by the culture, by the language we are speaking. Español, that's the culture. When Americans look at an audience and Jerry Springer, comparable audience, they say, oh, there's a black girl in the audience, and there's a white girl sitting next to her, and there's an Asian girl sitting next to her. They're making an assertion about blood. The Hispanic claim is a claim about ghosts. It's about culture. It's about spirits. It's about tradition. It is about all the ways we remember ourselves as created by the past, not simply blood, but in some larger sense, ghostly, because all the things we carry with us from the past, the most powerful things, are the hauntings that the past brings into our lives, the reminders of grandmothers long dead.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Richard Rodriguez is the author of the new book, Brown. This is Fresh Air.